Cormo v. Schultz, case number 82106. And we have Mr. Olson for the appellant, Mr. Bartlett for respondent. Mr. Olson, how do you want any rebuttal time? And if so, how much?
I'll take 5 minutes.
All right, thanks. That will be the order. So whenever you'd like to proceed.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Eric Olson, appearing as pro bono counsel for the appellant, Mr. Cornwell. There are two issues before the court that we've raised. The first is that the district court erred in considering hearsay testimony and effectively improperly shifting the burden of proof to the appellant in the case below, and the judgment must be reversed on that basis. We also have raised the issue of the court looking at this case and applying equity, which it must consider in this, under the circumstances of a quiet title case. Let me take the first one first. In his opening statement, Mr. Bartlett said to the court, quote, Ms. Clark majorly defaulted after that, and my client, or Mr. Sochi, maintained and informed Mr. Schultz at the time he purchased the note in 2018 that no payments had been made by Ms. Clark since 2010, close quote. Counsel's statement, which cites to rank hearsay, was never substantiated at trial by any admissible evidence. Respondent really doesn't dispute having the burden of proving his right to quiet title. But the argument that he met that burden fails because it depends on this inadmissible hearsay evidence.
Counsel, what do we do with the fact that I recognize Mr. Cornwell was representing himself during the trial, but he didn't object to the now asserted hearsay? What do we do with that on appeal?
Well, Your Honor, let me say a couple of things, because there are a couple of things he did object to, and it was noted in the record. He objected to the Exhibits 1 through 24, which is noted in the record.
When they were in bulk.
In bulk.
Yes.
And in particular, Exhibit 12, which is a written statement purportedly from Mr. Sochi, which is the closest thing to, I guess, some sort of reference to amounts that were due. He objected to that, and that itself was rank hearsay. The declaration of Mr. Sochi, which I think is Exhibit 25, he objected to it. Counsel indicates that it wasn't formally accepted into evidence. That's unclear to me, but he certainly objected to that. I would say this about the lack of objection to the testimony, which is the primary evidence that's offered. It is true that anyone, a pro per defendant, must follow the rules. However, in a case where you have such clearly inadmissible testimony in the form of rank hearsay that fits within the definition, clearly, the fact that the pro per defendant doesn't raise an objection can't be the sole determiner. I mean, this court has, in other instances where a pro per is representing him or herself, recognized that there has to be some leniency. There has to be, particularly when it comes to the intricacies of the rules of evidence. So it cannot come down to when there's it's not a debatable proposition that this is inadmissible evidence. So it can't really depend on that when you're talking about an individual who, if you look at the papers he filed, there's no doubt that he had a misapprehension of the law in any event, and certainly of the procedures. So I think in light of the nature of the testimony, there has to be some leniency given to Mr. Cornwell on the lack of an objection. Now, it's important to know that as far as the testimony, there really is just this one sentence that Mr. Schultz testified to. He said, quote, Sochi did tell me it was delinquent and no payments had been made. Last payment was 2010, close quote. close quote. That's it. That's the extent of his testimony. So it's inadmissible. It's frankly insufficient, I think, to prove his claim to clear title. But certainly, it is rank hearsay that is not admitted. Xochitl didn't testify, of course. And so what you have is a case brought by Mr. Schultz, the respondent, who acquired the note in March of 2018. He commenced the foreclosure 23 days later.
Sure, he bought it knowing it was in default.
Well, believing it was in default, perhaps.
Okay, fair.
He didn't know. He had no personal knowledge of the default in 2010. Right. He had no personal knowledge of the lack of payments, alleged payments, from June 5th, 2010. He had no knowledge of the balance owed, either when he submitted the NOD, which was recorded in the county, or at the time of trial. At one point, as I said, he tried to offer the declaration of Mr. Xochitl, but that was apparently not admitted. He said that he relied upon Mr. Xochitl's statement. We've talked about that. He doesn't really have a dispute as to the nature of the evidence. As you say, it's the objection which is the thing. And I think when you take out those other components and you're just saying the only evidence is this sentence that talks about there's a default because this guy who's not here told me that, you know, they haven't paid, that it is a, and it, if it hinges on the objection to that statement, that isn't right. That shouldn't be the linchpin, certainly if you apply equity to this situation. Now, I will say that there is a reference to, in the opposing brief, to alleged corroboration of Mr. Schultz's testimony by the appellant concerning a statement that Mr. Xochitl allegedly made to him at some undetermined time, I guess after 2010, in which he supposedly claimed Ms. Clark had not made payments. Of course, that statement is hearsay. And if you look at the question and answer cited, and then you go beyond that in the testimony, what you find is that that was never admitted to by Mr. Cornwell.
Sure.
He denied that there was the existence of a default. He denied that there was money owed. And so there's no corroboration in that sense. They talked about this alleged statement.
Thank you for that answer. The other one document that was relied on several times by the district court in the findings and conclusions entered was the trustee's deed itself and the recitals set forth in the trustee's deed regarding the default. And I don't think I've seen where any argument was made to the district court or to us in terms of an objection to the trustee's deed and its recitals.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the time, the instance arose where Mr. Cornwell was going to object to that. Certainly, he didn't file an objection to the NOD. He wouldn't have known how to do that. He didn't per se object to the trustee's deed. He wouldn't have known how to do that. And when the burden was on Mr. Schultz when he came before the court to say he gets clear title based on this trustee's deed. That's his burden. It's not the burden of Mr. Cornwell to establish otherwise, because that is he wasn't the one that came before the court, and he isn't the one that had that burden. The buck frankly stopped with the respondent. He needed to provide evidence, which, as I said, really comes down to that one sentence, a statement that's clearly inadmissible. And he can't rely upon something that is not reliable, which is the trustee's deed or hearsay evidence from someone who is not before the court. That brings me to the equity issue. I mean, again, I'll say that this is an action to quiet title. The district court sits in equity, was required to consider the entirety of the circumstances, including the status and actions of the parties, whether an innocent party might be harmed by granting title to Mr. Schultz. We say that an innocent party has indeed been harmed. And if you look at their relative positions and consider the equity, equities certainly favor Mr. Cornwell. The issue is a parcel of land. On the land sits Mr. Cornwell's home, in which he's resided since 2003. He's a senior citizen of modest means. He believed, and there's no contradiction to that, that he believed he had equity in the property, and the property was current.
Did you want to save the rest of your time for
rebuttal? I do. I'm gonna pass it this time.
Thank you. Thank you so much. All right, we'll hear from respondent, Mr. Bartlett.
Good afternoon. In response, I would have to say that the appellant is, counsel is relying on an argument that says there is absolutely no evidence in the record that either Mr. Cornwell or his ex-girlfriend, Ms. Clark, made any payments after June 5th of 2010. And he's arguing that the only evidence in the record is a hearsay testimony from Mr. Schultz that Mr. Schultz told him at the time they were negotiating the purchase of this note that no payments had been made on the note. So that is what Mr. Schultz knew when he purchased the note. And then he hired a company to conduct the foreclosure sale. And the company that conducted the foreclosure sale obtained a statement from Mr. Schultz, again saying that no payments have been made on the note and this is how much is owed. And that is in evidence. And during the pretrial hearing, before trial, Mr. Cornwell again indicated he's relying on what was designated Exhibit 9 to his answer and counterclaim as evidence that payments had been made on the note. And if you, I'm sure you've reviewed that document, and it has a list of purported payments that were made. Now, that document would have been inadmissible if anybody had bothered to offer it because Mr. Cornwell didn't prepare it. Mr. Cornwell admitted that he didn't make the payments, so he had no personal knowledge that these payments had been made. He also testified that Karen Clark is the one that, purportedly made the payments. And
I'm sorry. I apologize for interrupting, but I want to clear up something. Did you just say that Mr. Cornwell testified that he didn't prepare that list of payments?
That is correct.
And did he say who did?
He said Karen Clark prepared it, ultimately. And that Karen Clark had the so-called evidence of the payments, the receipts and everything that are referenced in Exhibit 9. But he did not make the payments and had no personal knowledge of making the payments because he's not the one that did them, that made them. So Mr. Cornwell also lacked any evidence as to whether any payments had been made on that note. And Judge Wilson admonished Mr. Cornwell at the pretrial hearing because by that point he had been served with a discovery request to produce proof of these payments. Now, Mr. Cornwell brought this up in the answer and counterclaim. The payments were made on this note. He also brought it up during the foreclosure process when he was served with a notice of default by Allied Foreclosure. He corresponded with Allied Foreclosure and saying, hey, payments have been made, and he sent them the very same schedule. And Allied Foreclosure, again, did not receive any evidence of any actual payment being made. They received this schedule, which is not evidence. And so they proceeded. So he had the opportunity to present evidence before the foreclosure sale even happened that the payments had been made on this note after May of 2010. He didn't produce anything.
Sure, but ultimately Mr. Schultz was the plaintiff claiming quiet title. So
indeed.
He has the burden to show with admissible evidence that he's entitled to title based on the appropriate process.
So by the time we get to the quiet title action, we've had a foreclosure sale where Mr. Cornwell has already had the opportunity to present evidence of payments that hasn't done it. Now he's filed an answer and counterclaim, again saying the payments were made. Discovery was sent to him, produced some evidence of these payments. He didn't do it. Judge Wilson admonished him at the pretrial hearing, you know, you can't just rely on your say-so. Cornwell brought this up, that he had made payments. He is unable to prove that any payments were made. That is what Judge Wilson primarily relied on in his findings and conclusions. That Mr. Cornwell said payments were made, but he was unable to prove any payments were made. So it was not just...
How did Mr. Schultz prove that payments weren't made, that it was in default?
Because Mr. Schultz was clearly relying on what Mr. Soci told him. And Mr. Soci had submitted a written document to the title company, or the foreclosure company, that this is what I'm owed, and the principal balance was equal to the principal balance shown on the note, or the modified note, that was created in May of 2010.
So if he was relying on what Mr. Soci told him, why isn't that hearsay?
I'm not saying it's not hearsay. What I'm saying is that going beyond that evidence, we have, okay, the title company was given evidence to commence a foreclosure sale. This is how much is owed. Title company proceeds with a notice of default, gives notice to Mr. Cornwell. Mr. Cornwell says, hey, you're not counting payments that were made. But Mr. Cornwell provides no proof of these payments. So the assumption is, at that point, no payments have been made. He hasn't backed up what he's arguing. So Mr. Schultz normally thinks the foreclosure sale went through based on the original demand. No evidence has been presented that that's incorrect. The foreclosure sale happens. He's the successful bidder. Now he has a deed. Now we get into the quiet title. And Mr. Schultz is alleging again that he is properly, you know, foreclosed on the deed of trust, and now he has title to the property. And in response, Mr. Cornwell files an answer and a counterclaim saying, hey, payments were made. And he attaches what he considers to be the list of payments, which, by the way, doesn't bring it current. It would still be way in default, even if all those payments had been made. But again, given numerous opportunities, he doesn't produce any evidence of the payments. So he brought it up. That's something now that he's got to show took place, or else his credibility, the payments were made, is in question, which is essentially what Judge Wilson told him. You can't just rely on this, a bald statement that payments were made, and then throw it back that Mr. Schultz approved that payments were not made, proving a negative. You know, he brought it up as his defense, and he wasn't able to produce any evidence of it. So that's not hearsay. That's Mr. Cornwell's statement that he was unable to back up. That's what the district court relied on, not Mr. Schultz's testimony that George Soci told him that no payments had been made on the note. So it's the circumstances that went beyond that, where we actually have a foreclosure sale based on a statement from Mr. Soci that this is how much is owed, and it reflects no payments made over that period of time, and Mr. Cornwell's inability to provide any evidence of any payment, not just all of them, but even one of them was not produced. And that is what the district court relied on, not just a hearsay statement. There's nothing in his decision that says, I'm relying on Mr. Schultz's statement. So that's the response to that part of the to that argument made by Mr. Cornwell on appeal. On the issue of the second issue, which is, was this a foreclosure of a residential property? I think the answer to that is no. Yeah, there was a mobile home sitting on the property Mr. Cornwell was living in, but that was personal property, not real property. The mobile home is not mentioned in any of the contract documents. It's not mentioned in the deed of trust, the promissory note. It's not even titled in Ms. Clark's name, Mr. Cornwell's name. It's titled in the name of a prior owner way back. It was never converted to real property. So this really doesn't fit into the provisions of the statute that pertain to a foreclosure of a residential property. It's a foreclosure of a bare piece of land. And that is what the title company that conducted the foreclosure sale concluded. They looked into that issue because Mr. Cornwell presented it to them. So they looked at it. And they sent him back and said, this is not a residential foreclosure, so you get the notice that's prescribed by NRS 107.080. And that's what he got. And I don't see how Mr. Cornwell was prejudiced by not getting a notice that would normally go to an obligor of the note that's being foreclosed, because he's not an obligor of that note. He's not on the note. He's not on the deed of trust. He's a stranger to that transaction. So he wouldn't have the right to modify a note that he didn't sign. So I think that argument falls because it's not a foreclosure of a residential property on which Mr. Cornwell is the obligor. And that is pretty much all I have to say today, unless you have other questions.
Do either of you have questions now? Okay.
Thank you
so much. All right, we'll hear from Mr. Olson in rebuttal.
Briefly.
I will say first that the document that counsel referred to, which is the handwritten document that appears to be from Mr. Sochi, is the one to the title company, Exhibit 12. That's the document that was objected to. Yes, it may have been offered, but it is also a hearsay document and ought not to have been considered. But it's interesting.
What's the number that I'm sorry?
That's number 12.
12.
But what's interesting. You know, Your Honor, I'll have to track that down. I don't have it on this copy for some reason.
Exhibit
12 to the trial.
Okay. So this, you're talking about the handwritten note that 3/16/18, something like that?
Yes, ma'am, 3/16/18. And it does say something title company, so foreclosure was the 23rd, so it does appear to be directed to the title company. Who wrote it and its contents, of course, are hearsay, and it's really unknown. But it's interesting, counsel says what the court relied on was the absence of of checks or a complete roster of payments from Mr. Cornwell. Well, Mr. Cornwell hasn't appealed the denial of his counterclaim. This is an appeal from the judgment of Quiet Title. As the court pointed out, the judgment of Quiet Title depended on Mr. Schultz, on the respondent, proving his case. He didn't prove his case because he didn't provide any evidence that was non-hearsay evidence. The fact that I don't know if it's hearsay or not, this list that was prepared by my client, because he would have been there to talk about it. But I don't know who prepared it, honestly, but it doesn't really matter. The point of this appeal is it wasn't his obligation. The obligation was on Mr. Schultz to prove that money was owed. And you can't rely upon what was submitted to the title company, certainly. You can't rely upon the hearsay statements of Mr. alleged statements of Mr. Soci. So what did they rely on? They didn't rely on anything they could rely upon. There's no question, counsel talked about the fact that this was a, what's at issue really is land. And there's no question that for Mr. Schultz, this was a land deal. He bought land. He didn't buy a note with the intention of, you know, getting paid by the borrower. He testified that he bought the note because he thought he could make $20,000 net equity on it. So the intention from the beginning was to simply buy the property. And I mentioned that, and there was no notice until the NOD. He bought the property. There was no notice of default the entire time. I find it difficult to believe that for 8 years there was no notice of default. There was no notice of default once Schultz purchased the property. There was nothing ever until the NOD, and then they complained that the NOD, the response to the NOD was simply sending this incomplete list of checks, but that's really beside the point. You know, this note couldn't have been enforced if it was in default for 8 years. The only option they had was to foreclose, right, because the statute of limitations would have run. But we have to consider all these equities as well. I think that the inadmissible evidence, which forms the entire basis for the decision, is the linchpin. We also need to look at, the court also needs to consider the equities. And the issue about treating this as a foreclosure of a home, that's important because I think the equities dictate it. It's also important because that gives, as the court knows, the homeowner the opportunity to do something, to try to mediate, to try to resolve this. That's the point. And at that, I will did my due.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. I also want to thank you for being pro bono counsel as well and taking a pro bono case. This matter will stand submitted. Thank both sides for their arguments today and all of their hard efforts. And we'll be in recess. Thank you again.